Welcome to Bulletproof. Today on Bulletproof, we're joined by Colonel Lisa Furman, Bronze Star vet, award-winning author, and one of the most respected leaders and truth tellers in the veteran community. She's got stories, perspective, and heart. Miss Lisa Furman, how are you doing today? Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, Steve, thanks for having me on the show. And I'm doing well. I'm doing well as best as could be expected with a 30-year-old combat vet body. You know what I mean?
You're not kidding. And again, there's so many things I want to talk to you about today. And again, before we get into the whole history and everything, what made you, did you always have interest in going into this field? Because when I speak to someone like yourself, sometimes that was always their life ambition, right? And then sometimes things just happen and they kind of fall into it and they kind of were at a road and it just went this way unexpectedly. So what was that like for you, Lisa?
I would say that the military was the family business to a certain extent. My father served in the Navy and in the Air Force and had a full career. So I grew up all over the world, overseas quite a bit, going to Department of Defense schools on military bases. So I grew up seeing that kind of sense of family, camaraderie, just the fellowship that they had, each of the service members and their families and how they took care of the families, right? So I wanted in. I like that. But so I went to college. And my dad was enlisted. He retired as a master sergeant, an E7. And he told me if I ever wanted to go in the military, that I needed to get a college degree and come in as an officer. So I became the first in the family to get a college degree. And then I came in as an officer.
Well, again, I know a lot of quote unquote kids and people I hung out with in my life that were quote unquote army brats, which is which is again, it's kind of cool in a sense where you kind of move around a lot and go to places that you would most people wouldn't dream of, and also it's tough because obviously you're in one spot for X amount of time and now out of nowhere now you're picking up and leaving and going somewhere else. Was that hard as a kid or was it something that you kind of seamlessly, did?
That's kind of the vagabond kind of lifestyle, right? You move quite a bit. We moved probably an average of 3 years, maybe, which is interesting because when I came in, I moved an average of 1.7 years. So we can talk about that a little bit later. But growing up that way, Steve, that was just normal for me. Now, for people who born and raised the same location and live there their entire lives have no idea what my experiences are like, right? But to see different cultures, to meet with them, engage with them, kind of live among the different cultures, living among the natives, so to speak, overseas. I learned a deep appreciation for other people, for other cultures, and it really widened my horizon, I guess, for that. So I enjoyed my lifestyle and the way I grew up. It's not for everybody. It's really hard on kids. I know that, but I kind of took to it. It was the opposite for my son. It was very difficult for him. So and I kept telling myself, well, hey, I did it. I went through it. But I didn't go through it as often as he did. So it was harder on me as a mother. When I was the kid, I thought this was the bomb. It was great. But as a mother, it was very difficult to pick my family up and move them every 1.7 years.
Well, you said something, and we had talked about this the other day. Again, for a while I was an NYPD police officer, and I had spoke to another guest, and they said, they wouldn't be able to last today if they became a cop today, knowing what they did, 20 years ago in the 90s, they wouldn't be able to last. But what you said was key because I almost gave the same answer in a sense where if you don't know any better, right? And that's all you know, per se. Sorry about that. That's all you know, then you don't know any better, right? So if that's what you know on a regular basis, then that's what you know. So people today that are coming out of the academy, that's all they know. So they don't know our form of policing from 20 years ago. So they only know body cams and cell phones and being recorded at any given time. So it's almost the same type of thing. So if you were somewhere for 20 years as a kid, and then all of a sudden that happened, and then you became, well, you wouldn't be at 20 years, but if you were somewhere until you were 18 and then you started moving around, that's probably tougher because now you have roots and you have that. But if you're just doing that, then it's cool because that's all you know, right? So with your son, was it something because again he couldn't have friends, or every time he had friends he had a ditch? What was that? Why did he have issues where you didn't?
Yeah, because when he had friends, he had to leave. I mean, it broke my heart. Some assignments were only 1 year long. So we would go, I mean, we're talking an 18-wheeler picks up everything you own, puts it in the back, and drives across country or overseas, and then you show up. I'll never forget the first time he moved. He was like 5 years old, and he was so upset because all his stuff was being packed up, and he had no idea when he was going to see it again, right? So I kept trying to tell him that you're going to see it when the next time we move, you're going to see your stuff. And I let him, of course, he carried some things with him, but you should have seen his face when we moved and then the 18-wheeler truck shows up and all his stuff. He was like a kid, like it was Christmas. He couldn't believe all his stuff was there, right? So, but I think the difficulty with my lifestyle versus my father's is as an officer on the command track, I moved every 1 to 2 years. So
Well, it's probably like.
you're moving for the promotion, for the command role. I was able to balance a staff job, maybe at the Pentagon, a joint command somewhere, and then do a field job as a commander. So the command track, you move a lot. I'm sure you've talked to senior commanders, senior leaders, and you move often. That's just the track I chose because I was trying to prove myself as a woman, as a Latina, that I could have these kind of roles. I'll never forget, I had another individual tell me, I think we're stationed in the Pentagon. And he said, why do you keep volunteering for these really tough field jobs, as a commander or whatever? He goes, you could just sit here and be a staff person the rest of your career. And no offense to any of your listeners, but I told him that I didn't have that luxury because I wasn't a white man like him. I had
Well,
to
I mean,
prove myself all the time, every day. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about because when you were in law enforcement, how many women were there? Not many, right? That at
and
that
if they
time.
and when we did, they were, especially if they were good looking, right? They would be either driving the captain, or they would be in the precinct, doing clerical stuff, or yeah. So, not too many. There was not too many women on patrol, and like I said, if they were attractive, they were scooped up by the captain, or somebody like that. But yes, you're 100% right. Which now, to explain to the listeners, explain the process of what the ranks are, so they can appreciate what a colonel, to get to the rank of a colonel. So, and again, I only keep referring to the NYPD because that's what I know, right? So you were a cop, then you became a sergeant, then a lieutenant, then a captain, and then obviously after that, you got appointed like a deputy inspector and full inspector, what have you, all the way to chief, police chief. So just explain to the listeners how the ranking system worked from where you were in the military, so they could appreciate how high you
Well, the
got.
military has two tracks, Steve. The enlisted track and then the officer track. And there is leadership all the way through, right? So I don't want anybody to think that officers are the only leaders. They are not. I mean, the backbone of our force is based on the non-commissioned officer, right? So my dad was a non-commissioned officer, but I came in as an officer. So you start out as a second lieutenant. And there's different commissioning sources. You can get your commission to be a lieutenant in the military from the academies, from ROTC or Officer Candidate School, Officer Training School. I did the latter. I came in what they call a 90-day wonder. I went through 90-day training, and at the end of that, I was commissioned as second lieutenant. So you start as a second lieutenant, first lieutenant, captain, major, lieutenant colonel, then colonel, full colonel, wear eagles, and then after that is a one-star general, and then you go
So
two-star,
I mean,
three-star.
so again, so becoming a colonel, I mean, that's up there. That's like where people, you're walking in and people standing up, right? And
Oh, yeah.
saluting. I mean, that's, so you had said something, earlier that I wanted to touch on, which is funny. It was a question I was going to ask you. Now, as a Latina, not only Latina, but as a Latina woman, right? Rising to colonel, what obstacles did you face inside the military culture? Was it, and what year was this, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, I came in 1980, and if
Okay,
you
so yeah, so all right, so.
one of my cousins or aunts is a retired detective from Los Angeles. So she came in almost the same time I did. She was one of the first women to be like a plainclothes detective. So we compared stories as she climbed the rank and I climbed the ranks. We compared stories, and they were very similar because, again, there were few women. 1980, there were very few women. Matter of fact, the first assignment I had was to a flying fighter squadron. And there were all male fighter pilots there. Women could not be fighter pilots back then. And I was the first female officer assigned. You could imagine what that environment was like.
Now you had mentioned, reading that you've spoken openly about military sexual trauma. So
Well, I've written a
what
whole book about it.
no,
So.
that's what well, yes, we're going to get into that as well. But I'm saying, when you mention that, what does that look like to Lisa at the time? What to you when you say because everybody has different opinions and aspects. Was that a common occurrence, and what did that entail, if you don't mind,
Yeah.
touching on
Well,
that?
I never really talked about this particular aspect of my service. I always talked about the great leadership, the command opportunity, all
We're gonna
that
get
stuff.
into everything, but I'm
No,
just
but what
saying.
I'm saying is I didn't openly talk about this particular issue till late 2020. I it was time for me to address my own trauma with sexual assault and my combat time, my experiences. So late 2020, really 2021, I started really talking more about it than writing about it. But yeah, so what happened to me is in initial training, like basic training for officers, I was sexually assaulted at initial training. And again, there were very few women, and it was by an instructor. So this is a person who had extreme authority and power over me. I mean, I was a nobody. I was an officer trainee. I mean, you're lower than dirt, pretty much, right? And so it was a very big power differential. And so I was assaulted, but I didn't say anything. I kept it all inside. I buried it. I became really good at compartmentalization. I wanted so badly to be an officer, and so I just buried it. And I really believe to this day that if I had spoken up back then, I would have been kicked out. I never would have made it out of the training to even be a lieutenant. That's how deeply entrenched this kind of stuff was, especially back then. And then my first assignment at this
And you're
fighter
talking the
squadron.
80s. I'm
Oh yeah,
sorry, I didn't get to tell you. 80, it was a different time. Now,
it's
forget
a
it.
different time. Matter of fact, there wasn't even you couldn't com you couldn't even go to anybody and report this. There wasn't a whole mechanism and laws against sexual harassment wasn't even against the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I mean, so my first assignment was full of harassment. Discrimination, and I'm talking both gender and my ethnicity as well. I would say that the gender was worse than the being a Latina. You know what I mean? As far as the discrimination and the jokes, and it's a toxic environment. I mean, Steve, they still had penthouse centerfolds on the walls. Okay, what we used to call beaver shots or whatever you want to call it, right?
All right.
I'll never
Well,
forget
you were kind
walking.
of in like a good old boys world, you know what I mean?
They had a bar in the organization, the squadron, that had a urinal on with beer on tap. I mean, that was set up that way. Okay, so they, back in those days, you played hard, you drank hard, you worked hard, right? And those were the days of wife swapping and all kinds of strange things going on, hot tub parties and you name it. Of course, I didn't do that, so then I was even ostracized even more because I didn't, go with the flow kind of.
So again, and again, I'm gonna say, being in a paramilitary organization, again, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, again, because even cops, they kind of say things, and again, between either ethnicities, and we'd go back and forth. I mean, but again, that was something that was kind of just part of everything, right? So
And some of
going
it
back.
was not even intentionally meant to be crude or rude, right? That's just the culture that we found
My
ourselves,
culture.
right?
Right,
But
that right.
you're talking chronic harassment day in and day out, and that can wear on you. And
Sure.
imagine you're just trying to do your job. So, it's interesting to me how what happened to me in my first and second assignments were very similar. I mean, I could have been assigned to a different place and I never would experience what I did, but I went to the most hyper-masculine unit in the military, in the Air Force at that time, a fighter pilot organization, right? A fighter squadron. And my next assignment was overseas in the Philippines, and it was in a maintenance squadron. So, and that's a whole different culture too, the people that work on the airplanes. And again, they play real hard, but they work extremely hard. And I went to that squadron. That was 700 people, only 10 were women. And I thought it'd be better and easier because I was replacing a woman. I wasn't the first woman anymore, right? But because of the limited number of women, it was, you take shots every day, verbal, sometimes physical, and you have to handle yourself properly, right? So I fought back my second assignment and stood up to anybody that tried to derail me from what I was doing. And I had to use a lot of bad words. My language was very vulgar on the flight line overseas. But I stood my ground, and because I did that, I gained some respect.
And I'm sure as you went up the ladder, when you got to the rank you got, I'm gonna assume, and you could tell me if I'm wrong, that
Do
stuff
that,
like that.
right? But you're going to do it on the side, and so it still occurred, but it wasn't so overtly. And because I had the Eagles on my shoulder, I had a lot more authority, and I could take care of things. I could nip things in the bud pretty quick, So I did that, but I don't want to disparage the military because I love the military. I wouldn't be the leader I am today if I didn't have all these experiences I had, right? But I just want people to be able to serve and not be harmed while they're serving by their by internal their brothers and sisters affecting them. So we got a ways to go. There's some improvements that have been made over the years, but
And
it still was.
we're gonna definitely get into that in a little bit. But so you had combat experience, correct?
Right. Yeah, I was in the Sunni Triangle of Iraq.
And what year was that? Was that in a Desert Storm or?
It was early 2004, Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Okay. And what again? What was your operative or what was your what were you there for? You personally,
Right.
what were
My
you there for?
role,
What was your role?
my specialty, Steve, in the military is expeditionary combat support. What does that mean? And for the Air Force, it means that I became an expert in building bear bases. Taking what we need to set up a tent city to protect it, fortify it, and then run missions out of it, right? So, and I had been trained throughout my career for that. So I was a by name request to go to Iraq by the Chief of Staff of the Air Force to be the first colonel to go in to build up the air base in the Sunni Triangle. So that was my role.
That's
So,
amazing. That's
right, it
amazing.
was and you know what, Steve, because of my experiences in the past, up until the time that I got on that plane with all my bags, my Kim gear, my weapons, all this stuff, until I got on that plane, I actually thought they were going to pull me back and say, "No, we're not going to send a woman to be a commander in that environment." I actually thought that in my head. I knew I was the most qualified, right, because of my training and because I had this by name request, right? And when you have a by name request like that at that level by a 4-star chief of staff, you have to explain why you can't go because you're going. And of course, I wanted to go. I feel this is kind of awkward to say, but for me, all the training I had up until that point was perfectly timed and whatever for me to do this role. It was like it's like you work out every day. Maybe you're playing football every day and you're playing these seasonal games or whatever, but it's like the Super Bowl. And I hate to say, people might think I'm crazy, but it was like this is the ultimate test for your leadership, is that environment.
It's not even it's even break it down even more. It's almost like again, like you said, for practicing
Right.
for a game, right? Being in training camp and just practicing, but never actually play a
Right.
game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you're
There's a big
practicing
difference.
is a big difference, right? I mean, absolutely. So, what was your experience that basically shaped you after as you were there, what do you think shaped you as a leader after that experience of going to a place like that, being in combat? What kind of changed for you as
Yeah,
a
well,
leader and as respect and as a person?
I thought, I was a good leader, and I thought a great leadership test, because the role I was in that I left to go to Iraq, I was the mission support group commander in a base in New Mexico. And that's like you're like the mayor and city manager all rolled into one, and you're taking care of the entire infrastructure for the base. I thought that was the ultimate leadership test, basically running a base, and then preparing for combat, whatever. But I was wrong. I mean, it's preparing, and then when you're in that environment, but all that training became innate. I mean, sometimes I didn't even think, I just acted, right? And in that environment, you have to, because if you delay, someone could be dead, and it really tested my leadership on a couple accounts. One is when we first started having casualties, and people were dying. You got to keep your people motivated, and remember, I went there. I brought 100 combat engineers with me, from the military, from the Air Force. But I ended up overseeing over 700, about 725 personnel from all over the world who came in there. And then I'm the commander, right? So you and I only 100 engineers knew me. The other ones didn't. But so you have to establish your credibility right off the bat. And then as a woman walking in the tents and there. I'll never forget walking into my first commander meeting with all the commanders on the base. And these are Army, Navy, everybody, Marines, everybody's there, and contractors. So you walk in and you're like one of three women. And they see this Air Force full colonel walking in, and they're like dismissing me just because I'm a woman, right? But it's amazing in that environment how quickly they came around when they saw, hey, that Air Force colonel can pretty much airlift anything you want.
She's badass.
So we
She's
started
real.
bartering. I mean, by the time I left, I got coins from the Marines and the Navy, and over the Marines became my best friends when we brought in 21 Abrams tanks for them during the Fallujah kind of flare up. So I mean, they stood next to me on the tarmac as these tanks rolled out of C-17s, Air Force C-17s, and they were like, man, they were just very grateful. So it's amazing how just be competent, just do your job to the best of your ability, then the people will fall in the line, right? So that difficulty leading and motivating your people when true adversity is happening, people are dying, and you don't have all the equipment that you need. I mean, one of my biggest limiting factors was I couldn't get an air traffic control system up and running fast enough. I mean, because we're building a base. I mean, again, I told you I had over 725 people working for me. I had millions of dollars to set up this base, and we're setting up the base so we could actually bring the aircraft, and they could be housed there. The F-16s and the special ops were already there, but we were using Predators, unarmed aerial vehicles to drop bombs and that kind of thing. So we were building up a tent city, fortifying it so people could be housed there, work out of there, right? So one of my biggest limfacts was the air traffic control system. We had to get it out of Germany. It's a transportable system, and you have to set it up, we had all kinds of problems getting it out of the country, getting it into the country, and I could do a whole podcast on some of the issues that came with that convoy, really.
So, transitioning, because this is a crazy, amazing stuff. What's the hardest story you had to deal with, whether it was casualties? What do you, when Lisa comes home, and I say, what is the hardest thing that has hit you, or something that you'll never forget, or what does that look like to you?
Well, the loss of life. I mean, as a commander, as a leader, I second guessed how I had that base fortified. I mean, I was the one who approved how the tent city was going to be laid out, how far each tent was from each other, how high the sandbag walls, how wide they were going to be. I had great civil engineers that came to me and said, hey, ma'am, we're getting 82 millimeter mortars in and that kind of stuff. And for blast fragmentation protection, it's best that we have this many. I mean, we have regulations that say everything. You need a this size, this thick sandbag wall for whatever mortars that are coming in, whatever. So we had to work through all that. But I started thinking, and actually, I did this there while I was in Iraq after we had our first casualties. I questioned whether or not I did a good enough job in fortifying the base, protecting, hardening the base, we call it. And I'll never forget, I'm standing there and there's no time really to mourn. I mean, you do that later. Every day in a combat environment is like a dog year, So I allowed my troops there to do a quick service for the loss of life that we had to honor them. And it was at a tent site, and then they wanted to put American flag up. Back then, it was so early in the fight, we were not allowed to put up the American flag in country, right? But I allowed them to do it at half mast, and we had it there. And I said, we're going to do this for 24 hours, and then you take it down and you put a new tent in there and you put troops in there, right? So a lot of people thought I was really cold when I did that. But I couldn't, I had to. I had to get them focused on the mission. And then later, so when I came home later, I questioned some of the stuff I did, and I thought about it. And I still think about the people that died and their families, that kind
How
of
many,
thing.
approximately how many, without, getting to the, exact numbers, approximately how many people, died,
Well, on that base, I mean, we
on
just
that
had
base?
a small number on that base,
I
but
could imagine, right?
any loss is huge, Steve.
Oh, any loss is huge. One loss is huge, but.
And I'll never forget, I'm the on-scene commander. So showing up to the aftermath of an attack, it was an 82 millimeter mortar that attacked and hit this one particular tent and killed the people inside and maimed some of them. And I'll never forget showing up, and it's black smoke. I mean, just everything's black. And this is, like 3 or 4 in the morning or whatever. It's all black. It's dark. And I show up, and then and I never forget standing there. And as the smoke started to clear, I'm looking down, and there's body parts on my boots. So we had to get a team in to take care of that, and then having to notify the families, and then having to do the try to do some kind of way, work with the chaplains to do some kind of service that we could honor them, but moving on, moving on. And I even we you know we built huge tents. We had tents that had a fitness center. We had tents that had movie theaters. I closed a lot of those. I shut them down when we had intel that said we were going to get hit quite a bit. And my troops hated me for that. But I did it because I'd rather have one injured instead of 30, right? Because you have too many people congregated together and you don't want that. So there was a lot of leadership decisions that I made, and I had to do them quickly, and sometimes I had to, use what I would say very command directed language, you know what I mean? To get it done, to get it done. So it was so I think I look back and I'm proud of what I did. And I'm really proud of my team and everybody who worked so hard, it was a true test of your fortitude, the fiber of who you are, you know what I mean?
I can imagine. And again, so now this is where I come full circle a little bit, right? So you actually were in combat, you saw combat. What advice do you have for veterans coming back home, right? So even you, right? So, you're a colonel, you're in charge, you're in Iraq, you're seeing all this stuff, right? Then you come home. And you're just mom, right? When you come home, you have your son, now your mom.
Well, I'm still a commander, but it's a peacetime
But I'm
role.
saying, again, you're a commander when you're working, but you're a mom when you're home. You're not a colonel when you're home, your mom, right? Like everybody else. Now you just come back from Iraq, you come home, and maybe not you, because you're again, your rank is obviously, you're up there. But for a soldier, a private, comes home after seeing actual military war action, and now he comes home and now he's just Joe, or and he's got to go to Costco and how or whatever. And
Oh, that is a great question. And it doesn't matter what your rank is. I don't care if you're a private or if you're a 4-star. If you're in that environment and you're in that environment for any length of time and you see action like that, it's going to stay with you. You're seeing, you're seeing dead people. You're seeing maimed people. You're seeing an enemy trying to kill us every minute, and then
And then you
you,
transition right away.
yeah.
You come
Oh,
back
it's
and
like
now.
going from fourth gear, really fast, down to neutral. And it is hard. I remember coming back being so angry at the American public and what they were focused on at that time, on celebrities and different what they were wearing. I mean,
Right.
I just couldn't grasp that. You know, there's people dying for our country here, doing the mission that we were sent on, and you guys are all you care about is what's on TV or that celebrity and that new song or whatever. It's like it blew my mind. So it took me a while to downshift, I guess. And I, like a lot of vets, I hate to say this, but sometimes we reach for the coping mechanisms that aren't healthy. So I drank way too much when I came home. You know, I didn't want to. I had to mourn, you know, I had to grieve our losses, but it was just a difficult transition time to come back to the United States that it's like they didn't even know what was going on over there. You know, and if you didn't have someone in the military that you cared about was coming, and you didn't care about anything, you know, it was an interesting way to environment to come home. I will say that I was very welcome very well came home. I mean, I remember land
Hey, Beneve,
me
she's again. Get up, sorry. Get you.
thanking all of us, right? And who were had we were treated.
Hey, Manib, she's getting frozen. Can you see me perfectly? Am I frozen to you, Lisa?
No, you're perfect.
Okay. All right, perfect. Because I have a couple more, and this is amazing. You're amazing. So that brings me to the next story, and my next thing is, do you think the country? And I already know your answer, but do you think the country takes care of veterans the way they should?
I think that they could do a better job.
How so?
I think they could be more timely. They could have more providers. They have some wonderful programs. They just don't have enough providers to take care of it. So they have an initiative called like a wellness initiative, and they even think about outside the box therapies like you know chiropractic care, acupuncture, massage therapy, even art therapy. Right? That's all great, but they don't have enough people to do it.
If somebody got into a situation where they were maimed or they lost limbs or what have you, do you agree? Because I think if that's the case and you that's happened to you because you were fighting for your country, you should be taken care of for life. Do you think, what are your thoughts on that? That the country should.
I agree. I mean, there's still less than 1% of the population actually puts their hand up and serves, right? So those of us that are out there doing in the trenches should be compensated and taken care of. I mean, I feel like sometimes I have to fight for my medical care, and I shouldn't have to do that. I remember
No.
talking to one of my doctors at the VA, and I actually had to, you know, get firm and say, "Are you not going to write that prescription for me?" I said, "I served my country for 30 years." You know, and I need that, and I don't understand why you're hesitating. And I said, "Are you refusing to write that script for me right now?" And I looked her point blank in the eye, and she looked at me, and she said, "I'll do it for you." I said, "Okay, but I mean, it's not like you're doing anything special. You're just giving me a prescription that I can get filled, right? But I don't understand why I have to argue, why I have to do that, right?"
Right.
I actually serve on the advisory committee for minority veterans for the Secretary of the VA, so I definitely speak up and talk about because sometimes it's even worse for us women. Or are those of us who are not of the majority?
So we had spoke, and that's amazing because again, I donate to all those, Tunnel for Tower, all that stuff because my father was in the Navy and then he was in the Army and he was NYPD, again, it was always. Yeah, very regimented. I never saw my father without being shaved. I never saw my father with a shadow. So I get it. And I'm pro, very pro with all that stuff. Now, I had mentioned something earlier, and then we're gonna close with your book and all that stuff that I really want to share with my audience. Now, I had mentioned if I was a cop today, as opposed to being a cop, what I was, it's a totally different job. What are your thoughts today from when you were in the military, and you were even in the military earlier than I was as a police officer? What are your thoughts to the military today as opposed to when you were in the military?
Yeah, well, I think in some ways they've made strides for the betterment of everybody who serves, especially in the last like 3 years. Some of the laws changed for sexual harassment now is a crime against the UCM in the UCMJ. So that's good. And they took sexual assault, the investigative part, the discipline part, they took it out of the chain of command. So now you have an independent person looking at that. So that's good because a lot of us didn't want to report it because we were afraid of retaliation or that kind of thing. So now the laws are on the books. Now they just need to be followed, right? So I think there's been improvement. And I think anybody who wants to serve their country should just go into it with an open eye, open eyes, read as much as they can, be informed. I would say read my book, because that's 14 stories of sexual harassment, gender discrimination, and sexual assault to include rape. And every branch of service is represented. It spans 50 years. It actually has two active duty people still in the book, still serving. I didn't use their real names, of course. I gave them pseudonyms. But so it's better now, but there's still this culture that needs to change, that still is not welcoming to a lot of women. And I was told countless times that military is no place for a woman, the flight line is no place for a woman. You shouldn't have been here. You should be, how many times? I just say, just watch me, man. I prove myself through my competence.
Well, I got two questions that are probably the not the hardest, but the most, that could be the most controversial, I guess. And it's a two-part question, so I'm gonna split it. And I'm gonna tell you, ask you both at the same time, and then I'm gonna get your answer. One, because you were very specific earlier about saying, I was a Latina woman. I got for that reason, I was held back. Do you think now, as as somebody who's beat all the odds, and now you're telling me things are different. Do you think that what they were doing for a while, as far as they were not putting the best person for the job, whether they're white, black, or Spanish, or whatever, because they wanted to kind of keep everything, at a certain, it should be a certain amount of African American, a certain amount of Latina, a certain amount of whites. Do you agree with that, or do you think the best person for the job, whether they're white, female, African American, Latino, should get the job?
Steve, it's always about who's the best for the job. There's no quotas. We don't have quotas. I don't know,
Well, there
there's
was, I
some
mean,
people
unfortunately, with
who
the last
believe they're,
administration, there was, but.
we track it, but there's no quotas. We
Right.
track it, okay? So, and I think that's important to say because and I always believe the best person for the job should get the job, whether it's a woman, whether it's a black man, I don't care. If you judge me on my merits, and people say it should be that way. Well, it should be, but it's not. So
Right.
just as long as you're aware of that, then you have to handle yourself a certain way. I have to work three times harder than the average white dude just because of my gender and my ethnicity, because people will have preconceived ideas of my ability. Like I said, I overwhelm you with my competency. And then you
Well,
can't say, I give no one a reason to never not pr to not promote me.
right. Well, here you go. So here's the last question I have, and I'm going to just speak about your book quickly. As a woman, and again, you just said all the stuff that I knew you were going to say. Do you think that when they were starting with transgender and all that stuff, do you think that again sets women back if you're going to put transgender soldiers in the army and putting them with women and putting them against women because they're identified? Do you think that sets back the women all over again? Because even with sports and this and that, I mean, you're technically competing against a man. So, do you agree or disagree with the fact that having transgender men in the same, I guess I want to say bunk, wherever, locker rooms, bunker, all the stuff? Do you think that? Again, we're not talking about, it's not a political show, so I don't care, but our president today did the right thing by cutting all that out.
Well, I would say that if you're qualified to serve, you should serve. If you can, and I don't care who you are. We don't have enough people that are even medically, mentally, physically qualified to serve. So we basically need everybody we can get who's qualified to serve, right? As long as you're qualified, I think, again, as a person who's been judged in unfairly, who's been underestimated, just I'll let, just judge me on my actions and my work, right? And so if a transgender person wants to serve, let them serve.
No, not that they should serve. I mean, they should be considered, if they just identify as a woman, should be with women and changing with women and all of that stuff. Do you think it makes it uncomfortable, or do you, it's fine?
You're talking to a woman who got dressed in my sleeping bag in a tent with other guys. So, I took care of myself. I would expect
I
them to
got
take
you.
care of themselves. You know what I mean? So for me, again, I fight hard for anybody to be able just to be themselves. And if they want to serve their country, let them serve their country. And I'm not going to get into
No,
bathrooms
like I
and all
said,
those
that,
kind of things. You know what I mean?
yeah, I
Because
mean,
I
no, that's fine. I could tell by your answer, that's not something you want to touch on, and that's fair. So, you've now become a writer, a poet, basically a storyteller. Does writing help you heal or help you make sense of what you dealt with? Or just let's talk quickly about your book and then how they could find it and then how we can find you. And if any of our listeners are interested in reaching out to you and all that stuff. So again, I'm giving you five questions in one, but
No, I appreciate it. Thank you, Steve, for letting me be able to even mention my books.
No, that's what
This
I'm here.
first book that I wrote is Stories from the Front: Pain, Betrayal, and Resilience on the MST Battlefield, MST Military Sexual Trauma. After Vanessa Guillen was murdered at Fort Hood, she was a young Latina and made national news. A lot of our laws in the military changed because of the current of the demand for change after her murder. It was a horrific murder in Texas at Fort Hood at the time. Now it's called Fort Cavazos, or it might be Fort Hood again. I don't know. A lot of changes going on. But anyway, after her murder, she was a young Latina, and then I saw myself in her, and I said, "Oh my God, this happened to me too. I need to do something about it. What can I do?" Well, I can write, so I'm going to write. So I it's 14
That what
stories.
inspired you? Is that what
Yes,
actually inspired you?
I was so enraged.
Mm-hmm.
I was so pissed off. I wrote that book, and I was like, man, I was mad. And I went looking for publishers, right? And some publishers told me, oh, you can't do that, write that book that quickly, right? I said, yes, I can. Don't underestimate a pissed off Latina, right? So I wrote that book and published it in 10 and a half months. And that means
Wow.
interviewing all these people and telling their stories. I had a woman, I wrote an opinion piece, an op-ed, and it was called Women Protecting the Military, But the Military Fails to Protect Them. And then that got picked up by Military Times, and it went all over the place. And people just started contacting me and telling me their story. So I decided, okay, I'm going to tell my story and then tell theirs. And I picked 14 of us to tell. There's, like I said, every branch of service, even two active duty people still serving today. I use pseudonyms for them. But it was important for me to tell their stories. And it's the whole continuum of harm. It's not just it's verbal assault, a verbal harassment rather than physical assault, and it goes all the way to rape. And it again from the Vietnam era to present day. The first person to contact me after that op-ed was published was a Vietnam grunt, a woman who served in Vietnam, who had 50 years had gone by. She never told her story, so I was able to capture her story and tell her story. So it just tells you this issue in the military is deeply entrenched for years, and it's right now the laws have changed, but the culture needs to change, and that's going to take probably another generation.
That's amazing. So Lisa, please share with the audience where they can find a book and then
Okay.
how we can get in touch with you. If somebody that's listening gets inspired, or whether it's somebody from the military, whether it's somebody that's just inspired, you inspire them as far as your story, as far as being a Latino, what female, a writer, poet, somebody that just you happen to say that touch someone. How do they find you?
Yeah. Well, I want to quickly show this book. This is
Oh
called
yes,
Latino.
please,
This is
please,
called
please. I'm
Latino
sorry.
Warrior, and this is Poems,
Please.
Prose, and Art. This is my autobiography, and this deals deeply. It talks a lot about PTSD, which I have, and I openly talk about it. It talks about sexual assault, talks about command, talks about growing up all over the world, making tamales. I mean, it's a whole accurate authentic description of my life along with art, original art. I partnered with another woman, combat vet, who also has a Bronze Star. So us two
Amazing.
together created this book. And I even branded this. I own the trademark for Latino Warrior. And so I have certain merchandise that has that. It was important to me, Steve. It took me a long time to reconcile the juxtaposition of being a Latino woman and being a military warrior. It took me a long time to get those two together and to really. So this book does that for me. It's also the healing journey. It describes my therapy and all that kind of stuff, my healing journey to where I'm at today, because I finally addressed the PTSD that I've been carrying, the trauma I've been carrying for years and never spoke about. So writing for me is healing. Writing for me saves my life. It along with some therapies and that kind of stuff, but the writing for me is the heavy lifting that has helped me get out of the abyss and help me from not
That's
being the
amazing.
statistic.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And again,
Oh, so you can reach me. I'm sorry. Just
no.
my.
So how, well, not before reaching you, how do you purchase either book?
Oh, you can buy them anywhere. You can Amazon. You can buy on my website. You can only get a signed copy on my website, of course,
There you
right?
go. Well, there you go.
So
And
and my website,
where is that? Yes. Where is that website?
it's lisacarringtonfurman.com.
You got to spell that out for me, Lisa.
Okay, it's well, it's
Correct.
LisacarringtonFurman.com. I can never forget my name, so it's my name.
They, and is, do you have any social media handles?
I do. Have a LinkedIn, and then I just got on Facebook recently, and a Twitter. At Twitter, I'm at Colonel Lisa. LinkedIn is just Lisa Furman, and then Facebook. I'm not sure my webmaster put that together, so I think it just might be Lisa Carrington, it might be Lisa Fur. I don't know. It's an author webpage for Facebook.
That's awesome. We got to get you on Instagram. We got to do
Yeah, I
that
know
next.
my artist buddy, that my vet who did the illustrations for my book. She's on all over Instagram. Yeah, I want to work part time now, but I am writing another book about veteran entrepreneurs. It's
Well, you
20
definitely got.
stories. It's 20 veterans who started, founded, created their own businesses, and the businesses are di as diverse as the people that I chose to write about. So I'm excited. I'm writing that now. It'll be out late next year.
Well, you got to let me know and we'll have you back on again to talk about it.
That'd be great.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you so much. We again, everybody listening today, this is Colonel Lisa Furman. Amazing. Great stuff. I could talk to you for hours. I'd like to thank today all my listeners. I'd like to thank everyone for making Spotify a top 10 podcast, Apple Podcast a top 5. And it's not because of my voice. It's because of amazing guests like Lisa. And once again, if you dream, dream out loud and stay bulletproof. We'll see you next week.